ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Film Philosophers.
We spend all our time here. I want to make a paradise. He's a stranger. We're going to let him sleep in our house. What are they doing here?
This place is too big for the two of us. All I'm trying to do is bring life into this house.
You're insane. Get out! All of you!
Thank you for your hospitality.
In our time of need.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Film Philosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven. Alongside me, as always, is the fatherly figure, Mr. Chad Riley.
Is it because of the beard?
You have a beard?
It's a small one.
Like, you know what?
Well-developed
scruff. In this light, I can see a little bit of the shadowing. I see what you're talking about. It's great to have you, Mr. Riley, as always. And with us, we are not alone again. We have a guest on the show, Mr. Spencer Williams, a good friend of ours. How you doing, Spence?
Doing pretty good. Glad to be here.
Spence is a longtime friend of both myself and Mr. Riley over here. So
I've known him longer than you have.
Whatever. You know what? This isn't a race, Chad. That's not very fatherly of you.
But yeah. Father does know best.
Oh my gosh.
Well, oh, mic drop.
We're gonna
show's
kick
over.
This show
Thank
off.
You, Spencer.
The Film Philosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week inside the ever-changing interior of VGB Studios. When you're feeling alone in a big house with only chores to do, you can access any episode of The Film Philosophers online on iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher, Player FM, Libsyn, or Google Play. New episodes debut every Wednesday morning. If you're feeling a little nameless, faceless, participant in the dialogue, you can fix that by liking the show on Facebook at facebook.com/philosophers and following us on Twitter at twitter.com/philosophy101. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com. I got it right this time because usually I get it wrong. Alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and Me, Myself, and I. So like I said, we actually have a great show in store for you guys. Spence actually joined us as we went to go see a very unique film, and it's not
Mother!
It wasn't so much as a film that's like brand spanking new. We are like about a weekend late. But
it's still not been seen by a lot of people, so it's pretty brand new to most.
True. But it I think...
Only the brave went out and saw it the first weekend.
The real big reason why we wanted to kind of check this movie out was more for the reason of the fact that, like Chad said, it's been a big talking point for a lot of people, a lot of critics, a lot of people that we both know in the industry that have been back and forth about it. And so, yeah, we decided to take our chances and go check out the movie.
I mean, better late than never, right?
It's true. So, yeah, as Chad so eloquently put it, we went to go see...
Mother!
Yes. a couple sees its relationship questioned by the arrival of unexpected guests disrupting their tranquility. Directed by Darren Aronofsky, who helmed Black Swan and Requiem for a Dream, the film stars Jennifer Lawrence, Javier Bardem, Ed Harris, and Michelle Pfeiffer. This music's really...
And not this soundtrack, but, I mean, it's it still fits.
It really does, and uniquely enough, and we'll get into more of the film, but it was funny because we were trying to find actual good audio for this show, because usually we have a song that plays.
Yeah, usually there's a soundtrack you can access, and this is the music from the trailer.
This is probably the only music I could find on this entire film. Like, I scoured YouTube...
And that's what you got.
And there's that crescendo. Wow. That's creepy.
Now, needless to say, though, this musical motif, though it really in some ways does fit the movie, it's not a part of the movie. Like, you don't hear music like that the whole time.
No.
You don't hear much music at all, ever.
Yeah, the movie's much more like basked in silence than it is with like, I mean,
sound effects, just sound natural effects. Sound effects.
So, like I said, we got a chance to go check out this film, and Spence joined us, and he had interest into it, and we were talking about it on a Friday, and we're like, you know, why don't we all just go see it on a Saturday? And we braved the Saturday night movie scene where there's usually a ton of high schoolers and whatnot, which was funny. Quick side note, it's hilarious how many high schoolers still try to get into movies that are rated R and are unaware that they need an ID to get into rated R movies. Because when we were in line to get our tickets, the group of kids that were to the left of us and the group of kids that were behind me, each one of them hit that same wall. They're like, oh, do you have an ID? This movie's rated R. You can't go see it. But we do have this cartoon going on right now. Or we have this.
Okay, that's funny.
So it was so great. So,
but you can go see Lego Ninjago.
Oh, yeah. That's
your one and only alternative.
Yeah. So we got a chance to check it out. And so this film is one of those movies that has really brought the many faces of most critics to the forefront. People who are either aware of what most filmmakers are trying to do, are either for it, and then there's those who maybe they really grasp the whole thing and they're just really against it. It's really brought about a larger conversation about independent filmmaking, honestly, because there's several sides to this, you know, to the outcome of how this movie goes. And there's a lot of people that are just really throwing their hat in saying, you know what, this movie's either garbo or it's, you know, it's a masterpiece.
Well, and there's a difference between, honestly, I know that this is not the be-all, end-all litmus test of whether or not a movie is good, although there's at least a common measurement. Rotten Tomatoes, currently, as we're recording the episode, the critical rating for whether it's fresh or rotten is actually fresh at a 2-to-1. So two-thirds of critics are giving it a rating of what Rotten Tomatoes then qualifies as fresh. But then the audience score, so that's 240 total reviews, two-thirds of which are positive and one-third are negative. Then you go to the audience score, which has 16,000-plus audience ratings, and it's only 45% liked. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because at least armchair movie critics, you and I go to a lot of movies and then talk about them on this podcast. And the way that you engage with a movie when you know that you're going to need to talk about it and whether or not you liked it and why and all that kind of stuff is different than just attending a movie and liking it or not. And there's a lot about the structure and the content of this movie that if you weren't trying to find something to latch onto and talk about, I could see easily being a casual moviegoer, and Spencer, maybe you can speak to this a bit.
I was about to chime in once you were done.
And like walk out and be like, okay, I'm washing my hands. I don't know what just went on. I'm happy it's over.
Yeah, see, I just went in thinking I was just going to watch it with no idea that you guys were going to invite me onto this show. And after you said that, I was like, I really want to watch this again because I feel like I missed 90% of this movie.
Mm. Yeah, it's this movie, it just structurally, thematically, there is a lot about this movie that is different than your typical movie. Like if you were going to a film, I don't care what genre it is or what, like one small example, and I know we haven't even started with what we felt like before walking into the movie theater or whatnot. No. We'll get to that in a minute. But like one small example, none of these characters have names.
Yeah.
They're never addressed by name because they don't have names until there's a little bit right at the very, 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 very end. After the climactic scene, before the, like, I don't know, epilogue moment,
mm-hmm.
There's a moment when one of the characters kind of names themselves and gives another character a sort of a name-like thing. It's more a character quality, but it kind of functions as a name. But aside from that, nobody in this thing has a name. And there's no clear definition on where you are, when you are. You have characters who possess smartphones and have modern clothing, yet you're kind of in this, I don't know, in the middle of a meadow somewhere in the prairie, and there's indoor plumbing and electricity, but it's just, it's kind of this in between. It's like in this constant limbo state of representing numerous different things. And I think as a casual moviegoer, it's really difficult to grab onto anything. I mean, even as a movie reviewer, for a while, you're kind of just, I don't know, dog paddling a little bit, like treading water, waiting until a piece of driftwood comes by that you can hang on to and say, oh, I kind of sort of know what's going on.
And that's really true a lot about this film. One of the things I've noticed, and I was taking a look right now, even though it's got certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, on CinemaScore, which is the industry leader in measuring movie appeal among theater audiences, one of the oldest ones around, they actually gave it an F. So, and I'm not too sure who all is polled, other than just, is it like general audiences? Is it certain types of audiences? Is it LA audiences as opposed to New York audiences? Is it, you know, in major markets? Is it in every city? You know, I don't know all that, but, you know, seeing as this is another kind of, like you said, not a litmus test, but more of a mirror of what some audiences are saying, what some people are saying. This film, so let me back up real quick. So Darren Aronofsky is one of those directors that you really don't know what he's going to throw down. I mean, I don't know if you ever saw Requiem for a Dream.
Mm-hmm.
That one was really wild and interesting. And I thought, like, for the longest, I'm like, this guy is nuts. And I didn't really hear anything after the fact. And then you get into stuff like The Fountain. The Fountain was really interesting. It was kind of beautiful in the way it was shot. I would say
arguably The Fountain probably had the most structure, mm-hmm. the most like discernible structure of any of his films, at least the ones that I've seen.
Well, see, then right after that was actually my favorite film from him, which was The Wrestler.
Oh, I love that one.
The Wrestler was a really good one.
I forgot that was him, but
there's no kind of like real meta existential, you know, unique quality to the film ultimately. But The Wrestler was a really great one. And then from there, you go to Black Swan and then Noah, which you're not a fan of. We talked about.
Yeah, I forgot he did that one, too. It's utterly forgettable to me. But you like, know, it's interesting. He's kind of like one of those. It's almost like he's avant-garde, but in a way that's palatable. Like, he's not necessarily like theater of the absurd kind mm-mm. of avant-garde. He's almost like a controlled avant-garde, like he still wants to appeal to a mainstream audience,
mm-hmm.
and yet he's wildly creative. His ideas are out there, and everything has a very unique, distinctive flavor. You know, you don't have like it's not that saying that you're watching a Darren Aronofsky film is not the same as saying you're watching a Steven Spielberg film.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
you know, Steven Spielberg has a very, you know, distinctive, appealing stamp of how he makes a movie. Almost always there are a few that maybe stand out a little on the fringes of that continuum, but it's very recognizable. Darren Aronofsky, it's recognizable, but not because it ever feels the same. It feels distinctive the way that his other films have felt distinctive, and it takes risks that other filmmakers quite frankly aren't even trying to take. Not all filmmakers, some do. But a lot of those who want mainstream success don't take risks the way that he takes risks.
True. And it's funny that you say that, because like this year so far, we've had films. I mean, let's just be honest. The summer wasn't as great as a lot of us had expected. It had some huge hits, but some of the ones that actually kind of stood out to me were, like this, the Michael Bay's. Like with the Transformers, you go and see a Michael Bay film.
Snore.
You know the similar beats, because he doesn't ever really change, and it's all for the worse. It's never for the better. It's not like, oh yeah, I'm going to keep doing this consistently because people like it. It's like, no, nobody likes you, Michael Bay. Go home.
Can we make it louder?
Yeah, like go home and take your camera with you and go home. And then you get things like The Dark Tower and It, which are based on Stephen King novels. And mind you, it's not a directorial project by Stephen King, But you do see a lot of those same beats from Stephen King projects, Stephen King books in those films. I think Darren Aronofsky is one of those types of filmmakers who I think just wants to appeal on some certain level. He wants to be able to say, hey, I'm doing something like this mainstream thing, or I'm creating something like this, you know, popular, trendy, cultural, relevant, you know, type of thing. Or and then once he like grabs him, then he's like, gotcha. And then he pulls you into the theater and you're sitting there for 2.5 hours, you know, confused, or maybe with a good outcome, like with The Wrestler, or, you know, whatever tickles your fancy. I mean,
I think that this one in particular is one of the most out there in his filmography. I was going to say discography. I'm like, that's not right. That's a recording artist. Filmography. It's
music.
This is absolutely one of the most out there, and not because it's loud. I really think that, you know, one of the things that we always try to start out with is, you know, how did we feel before we walked into the theater? Were we expecting good things, bad things? We weren't sure. What did the trailer lead us to believe we were going to be watching? And I think that this is one of those examples of, I went in not expecting to like the movie at all. The trailer made me believe that it was in the horror film genre.
Yeah.
Specifically, that it was going to be tense and weird and just not at all my cup of tea. And I went in expecting to not like it, which may be the reason why walking out, I didn't like it, but I didn't not like it. I felt intellectually stimulated by what the film actually was versus what I thought it was going to be. I guess I can say that's maybe a credit to the marketing team for not letting the cat out of the bag in any way in the previews. At the same time, none of what I expected to have happen really ever happened either. It was just kind of, again, it was like a limbo. Like, I'm not sure how to feel for quite a long time in this movie. Spencer, what did you think?
Yeah, I thought this was going to be a way different movie than what I ended up seeing. Like, I was expecting, you know, like, this husband invites, like, these people over, and then, like, they sacrifice Jennifer Lawrence to, like, this
exactly outfit.
That's what I was thinking this movie was going to be about.
Yep.
And it was nothing like that, and I was very surprised.
Yeah, because the trailer does lead you to believe, like, there are all these people coming over, and they all have an agreement about something that she's not a part of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's almost like a Wicker Man type of ending that you're expecting, like, oh, you know, they're going to put Jennifer Lawrence in this big Wicker Man and set it on fire, and she's going to be singing church songs. Going into this, so out of the three of us here, I can probably say I am more of the horror... I'm more of the person who would like horror films in general.
Oh, yeah.
And so for me...
Well, you've got that edge over me in spades. We've already established that numerous times. Spencer, are you going to have a thumb war over this one?
Oh, no.
Okay. All right, so you got it.
I got it. Okay, so here's the thing, though. For me, coming into this, so one of the things that I was expecting was I was expecting this to be like the next best horror film to what was the quote saying in one of the press releases, it's going to be something similar to Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
And so in my mind, I'm like, okay, I remember Rosemary's Baby. Rosemary's Baby is a really interesting horror film. If you don't know about that film, go look it up. IMDb is a wonderful place.
The original, not the remake.
Oh my gosh.
They made a remake of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Zoe Saldana. And Bradley Cooper.
That's right. That was horrible.
It was made for TV, I think. it was a TV miniseries.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't Bradley Cooper. Was it Bradley Cooper? I don't know. Anyway, it wasn't that long ago, but the original one is...
Yeah, the original one. Better. Hearing that, it lends to the idea that this film is going to touch on the horror roots that ultimately solidified the foundation for what horror was built on for today. What you eventually... come to see as the modern day horror film or horror genre. You know, Rosemary's Baby, you got The Omen, you got a lot of those types of films that were made during the 60s that kind of pushed horror to the forefront and no longer being a B movie type genre. So when you hear things like that, for me, my immediate thought was, well, this better be darn good if it's going to be anywhere close to Rosemary's Baby. And so I was half expecting this film to actually challenge my, because I know you were saying the film ultimately challenged you intellectually. I was hoping this film was going to challenge where I see horror, you know, where my fascination of the horror genre is rooted in. This was going to challenge that and begin to kind of recreate that foundation. Because if you're talking about creating a film that mirrors that of, you know, some of our, you know, most cherished horror films in the genre, then you're ultimately saying that you're recreating the groundwork that people now see as modern day horror films.
In a way, although I can say, having lived through and experienced this film, I actually get what they're saying about the next Rosemary's Baby. Like, I think what Rosemary's Baby is and was originally versus the reputation that it has developed over time, I think those are two slightly different things. And I think that with this film, who knows, what time will tell what people think about Mother. But I do get it in the sense that a lot of Rosemary's Baby is about the conflict of tension, of not yet experiencing the full level of grief, distortion, evil, whatever. Like, there's this sustained tension that runs, you know, through that story. It's less about being bloody and gory and ridiculously overly violent. Like, it's more, oh no, something bad is coming. Something bad is coming. Something bad is coming. Something bad is coming. It's that tension, 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 and it ratchets it up. And in a lot of ways, this film does a very similar thing. Except you have even less knowledge of what's going on the whole time. This film presents you with a sequence of events that don't always feel entirely connected to each other. The only point of connection is Jennifer Lawrence's character as your point of view character. You're with her the entire time. There are very, very few shots where you are not with her. Some of them, you hop outside the house for a second so you can kind of get a lay of the land, like what's the landscape around the house. But other than that, you're with her the whole time. When characters leave and do something else, you don't know what they went and did. You don't know where they went. You don't know when they'll be back because you're in the house with her. And I think from that perspective, I do understand why they draw the comparison to Rosemary's Baby, because you have this tension, tension, tension in it, and it sort of ebbs and flows, and things kind of, it's like something's going to happen and then it dies down again and nothing happens. And you're like, okay, is this where the monster's going to pop out? Oh, the blood through the floor, and then she discovered the secret compartment in the basement. Is this where the monster's going to come from? And it's not really about, it's not about the monster outside, it's about the monster inside. And I think that's where people are saying, some people are saying, okay, that's the connecting point for something like Rosemary's Baby.
I mean, if you're going to pull on one thread in terms of the comparison, I guess that makes sense. I don't know if I, you know, still want to throw Rosemary's Baby into that conversation in terms of any more comparison, just because if I think about Rosemary's Baby, other than the tension, there's a lot more to the entire overall story, obviously, and that's not what we're reviewing today. But like, in terms of the overall story that I look at that make up all the different parts of the film and why it's so great, other than the tension, obviously that's a key part. That's a key part in any suspense-driven type of film, which is most horror films. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. But so my mindset coming in was ultimately I was expecting that type of horror, that you know, jump in evolution, if you will, of like what horror is going to be for the next however many years, because Darren Aronofsky's, you know, changing the landscape. And I think a lot of that is lent to what the marketing campaign was doing. I mean, all over the place, all you saw were snippets everywhere, on YouTube, on TV, on, you know, on the radio, whatever it is, you heard like a 10-15 second snippet that started with a whatever the those weird folly sounds were, and you had no clue what was going on. You had no idea of the plot or whatever, you know. You knew it was more than just a simple, oh, guy and his wife have a home, weirdos come and invade their privacy, and chaos ensues. I mean, there's more to that, to the movie, than, you know, what meets the eye when it comes to Darren Aronofsky. I mean, the man could have wrote a better Transformers film, for all we know, better than Michael Bay, you know, more than meets the eye. but this type of film, the way it was marketed, I really felt like this was going to be something really big. I don't know. Am I reaching too far? Am I expecting too much from what I saw? Because, I mean, the marketing campaign didn't really deliver in the sense of what it was saying I was going to have, and the plate of, you know, whatever I was served was, you know, that I was given.
Well, I definitely agree there's a disconnect between what the movie is and what the movie was marketed to be. I totally agree with that. I don't know, in terms of gauging your level of expectation, I mean, I don't know how to answer that question. Like, it seems as though you may have expected too much. However, the fact that your expectation was based on a connection that's really not super solid. I would say, Eddie, it's not your fault. I think the marketing team, whoever they are, they had to figure out a way to build a connection to this film without making it sound as obscure and complicated as it ultimately turns out to be. Like, it is frustrating in this movie to sit there and feel like you only have 60% of the information that you're used to having in a movie.
Yeah.
And it's not to say things aren't happening. I mean, you've got dialogue, weird interactions, you get crazy people coming in the house and doing whatever, and yet you're sitting there, you're just thinking the whole time, like, okay, I don't know who these people are. I don't even know who Jennifer Lawrence is. I don't know how these two met. I don't know how long they've been together. Apparently, she has rebuilt his house and is, like, decorating it continually to make it better because it burned down in a fire. And, like, and all of this again and again and again and again, like, you're just constantly the whole time basically trying to figure out a starting point, really. Okay, I get what I'm seeing, but I don't know why you're telling me this story. I don't know where to anchor in versus just, like, let it wash over me and walk out frustrated because I don't understand what I saw. And I think that that's a huge challenge for any marketing company to fight with, or film studio, to say, okay, we have this film that we got behind, we financed, we got big name stars to be in it, we got a big name director, it's his passion project, he's worked on the script and whatever, and now we've got a finished product and we don't know how to sell it to audiences. And so they said, well, we'll release it during the kickoff to the horror film season, and we'll pitch it as sort of a horror movie. And there are absolutely aspects that happen in this story that would fit that genre. There are things that happen that are despicable, disturbing, and you'd rather not have witnessed. But most of the movie is really quiet and surprisingly domestic. Like, there's a lot of stuff where Jennifer Lawrence is cleaning up a mess that somebody made on the floor, like a broken dish.
I think,
or
that's about 60% of the film.
I mean, like, and it's so incongruous. It's so, like, why are we spending time watching this activity?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could make up an answer for that, but I don't know that there is an answer for that other than, well, it was something to do in between beats.
What about you, Sven? I know you had been talking about this film prior to us, you know, deciding about wanting to go. You had actually already decided you were going to see this film this past weekend.
Yeah.
And so what about the marketing really drew you in? What were your expectations when you were seeing, like, all the marketing, all the trailers, all the teasers, all the articles, all the, you know, everybody ranting and raving about what this film could be? What were you expecting with a lot of that information. What was the marketing campaign promising to you?
So I normally ignore like 90% of like the marketing. Yeah. I did see the trailer, however, and that one kind of like I could feel like the tension building from that, and that's kind of what like sold me on it. I'm like, okay, I'll go see something tense because, you know, we're walking up to Halloween. Because
why not?
Yeah, why not?
Let's give myself a heart attack on a Saturday night. Why not?
Yeah, so like I didn't have too many expectations when I actually like saw the film. And then, so it was really hard to walk away disappointed when you don't really expect anything. But I just did not expect this, like what I was given with this movie, which was just so much.
So jumping into the movie, let's go ahead and dive head first, shall we?
Let's do it. And for those of you playing along at home, spoiler alerts, we will give some things away.
It's true. The film has been out. And mind you, maybe you want to hear this for the sake of, you know, giving you a little bit of a guide going into it with, you know, with a little bit more of information. We'll pretty much talk about everything we can, everything that we feel still keeps, while still keeping the integrity of the film.
I mean, it might, honestly, in this case, I know sometimes it's awkward to say we're going to talk about spoiler rich information, but in this case it might actually help your viewing experience.
Yeah.
Because there is no guide rail in this film. Like, you either are sort of getting it or you're not getting it at all.
100%.
And I don't know that anybody is like sitting there like, "Oh, I totally get all of this. Every decision that they made makes total sense to me without any prep." Like, I don't know that anybody sitting there is like, you could say that because you're a boastful, proud person. But
I don't think I've ever said that statement in a Fast and the Furious movie, by the way. So
thank you for that context. You know, but I think that, I mean, the best you can hope for is having some frame of reference for what they're riffing off of more than anything.
Yeah.
Like, what is the source material that Aronofsky and his crew are using as a jumping off point for telling this story?
Yeah. So jumping right in, you're immediately introduced to Jennifer Lawrence's character, unnamed at the time, and she is...
Well, the first thing you see is the fire.
It's true. You get a quick 5-second glimpse of what seems to be a fire occurring and a woman being burned slowly as you see, and this is going to get a little graphic, but as you see the flesh on her face begin to char and burn up.
Yeah.
And then it's almost like as if waking up from a nightmare... I'm sorry.
Well, everything reforms. Like, everything
the house reforms itself
in ashes, and then the house reforms, and a shape takes form on the bed, wakes up, and it's Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah. And so Jennifer Lawrence wakes up as if waking up from some kind of nightmare, and she's looking for her husband. And I don't think she ever calls him a name.
Nobody ever calls anybody a name.
No, I'm just ever, I'm just trying until to reflect.
The very, very, very end, possibly.
And so she wakes up and she's looking ultimately for her husband, played by Javier Bardem.
Right.
And she looks all over the place and he scares her or whatnot. And so ultimately they are a couple. They are living in this home. She apparently has restored the home, and they make a point to hammer in this piece of information as often as they can, that Jennifer Lawrence restored the home by herself with her own hands. That's the consistent, you know, plot line or consistent,
yeah,
like idea that they're.
She claims it is true. He claims it is true. Their guests understand that that's what's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so he is a poet of sorts. He has written a book or a project. He has written something. And he is currently at this home with his wife to help himself kind of be inspired to write a second book.
Correct.
So in the midst of their day-to-day lives, it seems like they kind of have a little bit of a standoffish relationship. He's focused on his book. He's doing his stuff. She's just focused on the house and whatnot. And then they are visited by Ed Harris. Unnamed.
Unnamed. A old guy who says he's a doctor.
Ed Harris goes under the guise of saying that, oh, he thought it was a bed and breakfast and that he was planning to go back to the city to go back to wherever he was at to go and stay there. and of course Javier Bardem, who is very loving. He is one of the things that you recognize with Javier Bardem is that when immediately Ed Harris is brought into the picture, Javier Bardem becomes much more loving. You see a lot more of his affection towards this man than honestly towards his wife.
Right.
Like you see him like, oh yeah, you know what? Oh, let's sit down here. Honey, why don't you go get us something to drink? Or why don't you do that? Or, you know, okay, why don't we go and blah, blah, blah. And so he offers a room at their house, which is a large house, mind you. It's not no small cottage. It's a 3-story, mini roomed house. And so he offers a room to Ed Harris. They have a night and whatnot. And, you know, the husband stays up late hanging out with the husband.
Michelle, with the doctor.
With the doctor. The next day, Michelle Pfeiffer shows up, unnamed. And just quick note here, Michelle Pfeiffer is incredible in this movie.
She's so good.
She is.
She's so good in this movie.
I believe it was a friend of ours that we actually had on the show previous, Kristen. She had quoted on Twitter saying that Michelle Pfeiffer is the queen of the glare, because there are so many
she
times
she totally killed it in this movie. Totally.
So many looks.
So many looks. And the snide comments, the double-edged comments, and she killed it in this movie. And she plays the wife of this doctor that Ed Harris is portraying. But yeah, you've got this whole setup in this film where, yeah, you saw how the house is kind of laid out in one of the trailers that they released before. So you've got almost like a theater in the round kind of main foyer area, and you've got these breakout rooms all around the perimeter downstairs, and then you've got a staircase that goes upstairs to some of the other spaces like the husband's office, the couple's room, and then downstairs you've got a kitchen, a sitting room, a guest area that's sort of a whole other compartment on the other side of the staircase. There's a basement with, you know, washing machine and dryer and a furnace, an old furnace that seems kind of menacing. And so there's a lot about this film that is all about establishing an atmosphere, not necessarily giving you a lot of plot details or a lot of even a terrible amount of character insights. They're fairly generic in a lot of the information that the characters present to you.
Entirely, 100% generic. There is no name mentioned. There is no information given. There is no, you know,
like, you don't know where Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer came from. You know that they're traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Harris, before the first night's even over, he admits that he's not actually in town for a doctor's conference like he originally told them. He's basically, he's really appreciative of this poet for what he wrote, and he wanted to, he has a health condition, he might not be around for too much longer, and he wanted to meet this guy before he passes away, and that's why he came. And, you know, his wife follows him, but they do so much to set up the atmosphere and to have you kind of with Jennifer Lawrence, who's a little on the outside of most of these interactions. The first really in-depth interaction she has with another character is when she and Michelle Pfeiffer are left alone in the house as the men go out on a walk. And that's when you have a whole flurry of dialogue that doesn't even go terribly well. But
no,
that's the most dialogue you have up until that point, because most of her experience is kind of being on the outside of the dynamic between her husband and this other guy. She doesn't exactly get it. She doesn't know why her husband is so inviting. Like, he's a stranger. Why would you let him in the house? Totally valid concern. We don't know who he is.
Which completely, if you're unaware at this point in time of the film, you're wondering the same thing. Like, dude, it's just you and your wife, and you're way older than she is, and you're just inviting these strangers into your home. Like, there's something up, you know, there's something wrong up there in the old noggin.
Yeah, and like Javier Spencer Bardem, like you said, from the trailers, you're expecting, like, do all these people show up and like cut her into tiny pieces and eat her, or like it's a horror movie, right?
Oh yeah, I was expecting her to be murdered.
Yeah, you think, or the house is alive somehow. You kind of get a lot of hints that the house might be alive.
Yeah, I definitely thought that because like it shows like Jennifer Lawrence just like walking up to walls and like trying to listen, and then like it reveals like a heart beating inside the house.
Yeah.
And that was really funky.
And that was another consistency yeah. throughout the whole film, because
not normal.
She does that several times yeah. throughout the entire film. She leans onto a wall, she touches it, and you know, all of a sudden she looks like it's like she can see right through the wall to like the heart of the home. And I'm literally waiting. I'm like, this house is going to transform. I know it. Michael Bay had a part in this. I know he did. Oh, this is going to turn into Optimus.
Mercy.
Primal Victorian house or whatever. I don't know. But this, yeah. So at this point, you're uncertain as to what's going on. All logic is tossed out the window because these two people came out of nowhere. You know, there's no cars. There's no nothing. Because they, like,
yeah, Chad they just said, show up.
Like Chad said, they do like these outside house shots, and you just see this huge meadow like surrounding the house.
Yeah, there's not even a road up to that.
There's there's not even a garage.
No, there's like meadow and then trees outside of that.
Yeah.
And this house is in the middle, and it's, you know, all symmetrical and everything. It's almost like a compass in a way. But yeah, there's no walking path. There's no driving path. There's no indication that there's any sort of traffic ever in and out of this house.
So it's about this point, and mind you, we're going to stop right here in terms of like the characters, because this is kind of the core, if you will, of what's, you know, sets everything into motion for the rest of the film.
Well, there is one more thing that we should talk about, which is the boys.
Go ahead. Go
for it. So Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer, man, woman, married, right, have been for years. They have two grown sons that they talk about as they're totally imposing. I mean, they're like... Michelle Pfeiffer, even though she's been there for all of 10 minutes, has a whole load of laundry that she wants to do in their house. She uses the opportunity to make suggestive comments about whether or not they even want or try to have children, the Javier Bardem and Jennifer Lawrence. Meanwhile, she and her husband are getting their freak on every once in a while.
It's true.
Awkwardly, randomly, in ways that they shouldn't be doing in a place that they are guests in the home.
It was very upsetting.
Very, very, and I mean, the looks, everything. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer, again, tears up every scene that she's in. But then what happens is there's this constant tension for Jennifer Lawrence. She wants these people gone. She doesn't know why her husband is so inviting to them. They're strangers. They're antagonistic. They like him, but not her. She doesn't know why. They're not friendly. They're imposing on her house. She wants them gone. Then they trespass in his office, which she had already told the woman not to do. They trespass in the office. They break something that's very valuable to him. He freaks out. He closes up and boards up the office. And then as she is trying to be kind of protective of her husband and just take charge and say, okay, get out. You need to get out. Then suddenly there are these two young dudes that come into the house. I mean, grown men, but like, you know, 20s. And they're the two sons that have just randomly shown up. And they are in a tizzy about the will, the father's will, because the father has a medical condition. He's nearing the end of his life. And the sons are at odds about the contents of the will. You never quite know exactly what the will says. The brothers get into a terrible fight. Nobody's really stopping them. Jennifer Lawrence pursues them into another room, trying to yell at them to get them to stop. And one brother kills the other brother.
One brother kills the favored brother.
Yeah, the one who feels like he's never been the favorite kills the one that he feels has always been the favorite.
Yes.
And, you know, she's so close to it that the blood kind of spatters onto her face and her dress, and she's in shock, and she's not sure if she's going to be next. And you're thinking, like, oh, okay, so this is where stuff is going to kick up. Like, these are murderous people. They're coming here. They've been taking advantage of hospitality. They've been making pointed comments, and they're going to do something horrible to her. Not that you want to see that happen, but at least it starts to make sense in your brain, like, oh, that's what the trailers were starting to show you. But no, that's not what happens. And ultimately, we won't give away everything, but she ends up alone in the house cleaning up the blood and noticing that the blood has had an effect on the house, on the part of the floor of the room where the murder happened. And then she goes into the basement to start exploring, you know, how she could further clean the blood that appears to be seeping down through the floor into the basement. And then you're thinking, okay, so it's not the people, it's the creepy house. The creepy house is going to come to life and try to eat her or something. I don't know.
Transformers.
And that's not what ends up happening either.
Nope.
And so you start to realize, okay, wait a minute. Maybe I missed something, or I have to pay a lot closer attention to what it is that you're showing me. Yeah. It was around this time. It was the killing, the one brother killing the other brother was, because I haven't read any reviews of the movie or paid attention to any of the critical feedback or whatever. So it was around this time I was thinking, oh, so it's sort of like Cain and Abel. And for me, that was like the one hook, that was the one thought that finally helped make sense of a few of the beats that they were showing you on the screen. Mm-hmm. And it was a fleeting thought. It was only because I'm familiar with, you know, stories from the Bible. And so Cain and Abel, like one brother, the hated brother killing the favored brother, I was finally starting to, oh, okay, that's a recognizable element of a story.
Yeah.
And then from there, as the rest of the movie goes on, there are quite a few other connecting points that kind of at least allude to some of the source material that he was using for the skeleton of the story.
What about you, Spence? Did at any point in this early part of the film, because mind you, this is only within like what, the first 30 minutes, and this is a...
Well, probably within the first hour. I mean, this is a long movie.
Yeah, it is.
It's hard. It's really hard to tell how much time has passed because so much of it, you're watching her clean something.
Yeah. Did it become apparent to you? Like, did you become aware as to what this movie was talking about around this point?
No. Every time something like happened or like even got hints of something, something would happen to Jennifer Lawrence and then I would just be overly concerned about her. It's like, oh gosh, you've got blood on your face, or oh no, they've taken your baby. Like, it was constantly like me just over focusing on Jennifer Lawrence and what was happening to her versus trying to like, oh well, what's happening around Jennifer Lawrence. Mm-hmm. It was very hard to like really get into like what was actually happening in the movie because I was just so distracted with these people just being in Jennifer Lawrence's house. Get out of her house. I don't know why you're here.
You heard it here first, folks. Get out of her house.
Get out of Jennifer Lawrence's house.
And I think, honestly, for the rest of this film, it's just one whole, you know, rapid just toss into chaos as from that point forward, the film is just boom, 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 boom. You know, I think the more quieter parts of the film are within that first hour, because after that, after the incident with the two brothers, the film just like ramps and kind of just rams forward through the rest of the storyline. The husband opens up the home to the grieving family, whom they invite all their friends over, whom their friends are inviting other friends over, and it's just this
all
huge...
these people show up out of nowhere
yeah.
with food and whatever and just basically help themselves to the house, every space in the house, including her and her husband's bed.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and it was weird. So ridiculous. Like, she'd be like, "This is my house," and then people would be like, "Whatever."
Yeah,
like,
your house. Like,
yeah, your house. It's like, dude, you're literally sitting on her bed. Like, her clothes are right over there next to you. But this type of storytelling, it's really unique because it hit on a lot of the beats that, like I said, in that first hour, it hit like beat, space, beat, space, mm-hmm. beat, space. And then as soon as kind of the catalyst, if you will, for just the rest of the story to unfold, right after the fight between the two brothers and what happens. It almost results in like a rapid fire delivery of like all the main key points right after that of what's happening. You have the grieving family going through their thing, and then you have the just craziness of what happens after that, and then you have
you have a version of the flood story in a way. I mean, so you've got your picture this. The doctor and his wife are sort of ciphers for Adam and Eve. The sons are Cain and Abel. The grieving family that is just inviting themselves into this house. Ultimately, they end up breaking part of the kitchen sink, and the water goes everywhere. And like all over the house, there's water everywhere suddenly. So there you've got a flood, a version of the flood narrative. Everybody clears out of the space except for J-Law. And to a certain extent, Javier Bardem, he leaves and comes back. And then that evening, I mean, then there's a confrontation of, because of everything that was exchanged between J-Law and Michelle Pfeiffer about kids or no kids and whatever, she confronts her husband. You know, they are together that night. The next morning, she wakes up and says, I'm pregnant. Like, then you're back and like, okay, so this is a fairy tale place. Like, I mean, it's constantly shifting. I mean, it's like a chameleon made out of smoke. It's constantly shifting what it's showing you so that you're still not entirely sure what kind of movie you're watching.
Yeah, 100%. Because, like I said, a lot of these points are just immediately just placed in, and there's a lot less space in between some the important parts of the film as with the first hour. The first hour, obviously, is establishing kind of the parameters as to what the environment is and where you're at and who you're working with and who you're watching and who you're following. And then right after that scene where she's like, oh, I'm pregnant, and he gets excited, he gets up, he's inspired, he starts writing, and it's just like from there, it's like the lull before the storm.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get a moment where they're like, okay, looks like things are getting back together, they're gonna have a family, they're doing their thing,
it's all calm again, it's just the two of them in the house.
And then while they're having a nice celebratory dinner for his success, apparently he finished that second book and, you know, whatnot. And in the midst of that, it's like a bomb drops in the middle of this movie and all hell breaks loose. Like, he is...
Literally, yeah.
Apparently the last page of the book that he lets his wife see is instantaneously in the hands of his... what do you call it? Of his publicist.
The editor from the publishing company, yeah.
Who's like, oh, it's going to be great or whatever. And all of a sudden, there's like all these people that show up in their front yard and are taking pictures. And it literally goes so quickly in terms of like how things change event-wise from that point forward that it would be a disservice to you if we tried to rattle off every single one of the things that happened.
But just basically take any unfortunate, tense situation in the world today and imagine having a small vignette of that in this house at some point, because that's essentially what it reflects. A lot of the tension of our world today in that particular sequence, which is stunning. I mean, it's sobering, but it's stunning how much the visuals can communicate, you know, to, you know, your, I don't know if you, you know, your soul, your spirit, your greater sense of purpose or whatever. Like there's, I think that the climactic sequence where there's a lot going on, I mean, it's basically just force feeding you. You don't have time to really interpret. You don't have time to even process what you're seeing before you've moved on to something else. As she's trying to navigate her way through her own home as it's, you know, kind of unraveling all around her. But
literally, and you don't mean that figuratively, literally the house is coming apart and there are people that are just jam-packing themselves into it and it's just...
And they're taking their stuff.
Yeah,
and
they're taking door frames.
Yeah, like, I mean, it is mayhem and chaos. And I mean, like during that sequence, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, so there's the biblical thing going on. This is like a commentary on, I don't know, maybe the way that we live nowadays and how selfish we are and how we don't notice some of the terrible things that are happening because of our own actions in the world or whatever. And then I'm thinking some of it's a commentary on celebrity and how everybody you know, celebrities, of course, want to kind of wall themselves off in their mansions because everybody wants a piece of their life and to pretend like they actually know them in reality, and yet you don't. Mm-hmm. So some of it was kind of that level. There's just a lot going on when yeah. the movie doesn't tell you what to think. It just presents all of this, especially visual information, but also auditory. But it presents all this information, and you are left to synthesize and make something out of all these pieces.
What were some of your first impressions once the film started ramping up and a lot of these things just started happening like instantaneously? How were you able to keep up with everything that was going on?
Oh, I did not. Like, let's not have any jokes about that. Okay, like let's take the Jennifer Lawrence says she's pregnant part. Like, I thought she was saying, like, because, like, there was, like, a sunbeam on her. And, like, I had caught in some of, like, the religious allegory. So I was thinking, did she just, like, get impregnated by Zeus through that sunbeam or something? Because that happened in, like, one of those stories.
Sure.
And I was like, I was all over the place in this movie. But, like, especially as we get to, like, the ending and, like, once people start showing up and, like, the house is under attack from whomever, like, I was just like, okay, we're just watching what happens because I have no idea how to make, like, heads or tails yeah. of this.
It's true. And like Chet said, there's a lot of information that's coming across. And I think one of the easiest ways to parallel what you're experiencing is kind of like if you think about, like, some of the most intense roller coasters that are out there. You have obviously the buildup and you have the large drop and everything's happening. And then you kind of have usually that second kind of lull where you come to a stop and then it just drops down into the last string of like loop de loops and turns and your brains are coming out of your nose and all that kind of stuff. And well, your brains aren't literally coming out of your nose. Don't look at me like that.
Well, some of these characters, in a way, I mean, they did.
It's true.
I mean, you've got people being executed. You've got human trafficking. You've got riot gear and like protesters against police. You've got yeah. military people coming in. You have bombs and grenades going off, all while she is pregnant trying to like escape the terror inside her own house.
Yeah.
And all of it is these just these little vignettes of things that we see in the news all the time. And there's got to be some layer of, if you're paying attention to what the story is trying to tell you, there's got to be some layer of, okay, what if you literally brought this home with you? Like, what if this literally was your life? And I know for some people who are listening to the podcast, you might have experienced one or more of these events. You know, like you may have been part of a peaceful protest that went wrong and yeah. the police and the riot gear came out. You may have been in the military in a war zone. You may have been or know somebody who was hopefully rescued from human trafficking and not, you know, still a victim of it. But, you know, these are little snippets of real world scenarios. And of course, she's trying to get back to her husband and to a position of sanity as her house is coming down around her, not from her own actions. Sometimes she recovers a moment with him and others not. You know, there are ever more people crowding this space. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, there's a lot to chew on.
So obviously we're not going to reveal the way this no. film ends. It's as much as I'd love to be that type of reviewer, just like, oh, this is what happened and this is what happened. That's what happened. And this is what happened. And that's what happened.
So now you don't have to see the movie.
Exactly. this is still, I feel a film that holds a lot of artistic merit. In terms of being able to see a film and a visual representation of what somebody is interpreting, a famous work or you know, the word itself, the Bible, you know, somebody's interpretation of that and seeing that mirrored on screen and being able to kind of gauge what his thoughts are and how he's interpreting it. So by all means, you know, check it out. But one of the things that I can honestly say is with the way this film ended towards that last part and the way the film ends, I can see where people were having issues. Mm. trying to follow, trying to understand. Like we said, you know, all three of us immediately right after the theater was like, if you're not aware of the stories that this film is sourcing its material from, you're going to have a bad time. You know, it's going to be really difficult for you to follow the narrative that is occurring mm-hmm. from this, for this film from beginning to end. And luckily for us, well, at least for me and Chad, you a little later, but that was very apparent towards the beginning of the film. Well, towards the first half hour or whatever, whatnot.
Right.
It became obvious. And so jumping on that early in, I didn't have to think as much in terms of like, okay, where are they getting this from and where are they getting that from? Because what I could do is I could actually see the film and then see how it relates to the knowledge that I already have of the source material already established. And so it wasn't that difficult to draw the parallels and see where things were coming from. But for people who are not aware, this film will throw you for a loop. This is a very confusing film, and it's one of those types of movies where if I step outside myself and be like, okay, I am not going to be me for a quick second. I'm going to step outside and look at this from a perspective other than my own. If I was looking at this film and I was watching it and I was unaware, I'd be like, this is the most ridiculous, discombobulated, confused to the ultimate heck film that I've ever seen, and it doesn't make sense, and it looks like it's just some kind of political whatever, and you know, it's some kind of artsy fartsy film. You know, that's honestly what I would have came out with thinking. But
and I wouldn't say that you're wrong. I think that in a very real sense,
that's my technical term, Spence, artsy fartsy.
Artsy fartsy. Okay, I don't think you're the first person to use that term though, so we'll have to check the trademark later. But I think honestly, this is one of those rare instances where I could probably actually argue that the three of us did not see the same movie. Like, yeah, no, we saw the same film. We saw the same images projected onto a screen, but because it leaves, I don't know, 40% of the work to you to put the pieces together and draw, like, develop some sense of meaning out of it, it expects a lot of you as an audience. And
oh, yeah, no doubt.
Because it does, you come away, like, whatever I went into this experience already possessing on my own in terms of, I don't know, life experiences, exposure to source material, you know, stories or whatnot, my own, you know, relationships with human beings in the real world, like whatever, my viewing of the news at night, whatever I go in with, and then whatever it gives me on the screen, and then I synthesize and pull out something or nothing, and that's the movie I saw. But your story is going to be different. Your story is going to be different. Anyone who's listening is going to have a different experience. And I think that it's extremely rare for an art piece, an art product to pull something like that off. And I'm not saying that it's like flawlessly done, but to like the movie Inception, a lot of people walked out of that movie and they're like, man, I just have to sit here and think about what I saw. But aside from whether or not the top falls over at the end, eventually everybody kind of comes to a general consensus about here is what the story was telling me. Plot point A, B, C, all the way to the end. A movie like this, yeah, you've got certain plot points that everybody can agree. The man showed up and then his wife showed up and then their son showed up and one son killed the other son. Like you've got some basic mechanical elements that you can say, okay, we all agree that these are the events that occurred. But when you get to the why, when you get to the significance, when you get to the what did it all mean, that's left up to you. I don't think that this movie, as much as some people are claiming it tells you to think this way or it tells you to think that way, I honestly don't think it tells you what to think. I think what you think coming out of it says at least as much about you as it does about the people who made the film. And that is a rare experience.
Spencer, did you have any issues with the film? Anything that you know, didn't agree with or anything that didn't agree with you? Without giving too much away.
Yeah, without giving too much away. No, my issue was, I guess, how I viewed the film and over-attaching to Jennifer Lawrence, especially as, like, certain things near the end started happening. Like, she kind of got in the way of seeing, like, other things the movie was trying to do. But,
it's a good observation.
That's a good point.
Because, like, there's, like, certain times where, like, they're doing things, like, especially, like, after she has the baby and they like, parade around with it, like, I'm so like, just give it back to her. What are you doing? Versus like seeing like allegories they're doing with like the baby and stuff.
Right. Right.
So like, there's like a lot of things that are like misdirects that they use with Jennifer Lawrence that kind of like threw me off of like what was actually going on.
True.
Yeah, there are a number of moments to your point where you kind of want to like the camera is used as if it's looking over her shoulder, right? And you're like, okay, but if I feel like I'm literally standing in the room, I kind of want to just like move you to the side and like go around you or go like literally look up over your shoulder at what you're looking at. And in a way, because she's almost always in the frame, sometimes she's literally in the way,
right,
of whatever you're supposed to see.
What about you, Chad? Did you have any issues with the film?
Oh boy. I did. My issues were mostly in terms of in between the major beats. I've mentioned a couple times already, like, I don't understand why you had to like spend so much time with her cleaning up other people's messes. I understand she's cleaning up their mess. She shouldn't be the one that has to do it. She gets no appreciation or respect for having put up with their mess in the first place and then cleaning up. I get all that. I get the significance of what she's doing, but literally the amount of screen time that is spent standing or sitting with her cleaning something in various rooms of the house, that got a little aggravating after a very short amount of time, because you're fighting to figure out, is the house alive? Are the people a cult? Are they going to kill her? Is she going to turn out to be the ringleader and they're going to kill him? Like, you're making up all these things in your mind about, because you have so much time initially. You've got so much time to fill where there's not a whole lot happening on the screen. And you're like, okay, so let me try to predictively figure this out. And then, of course, you're totally wrong about everything. And when things finally do ramp up and they go totally crazy, then I felt like, okay, well, then all that extra thinking in the beginning was wasted time. Like, you could have gotten to this a lot quicker. That would be one of the things that really frustrated me. The other one is, and I understand the purpose for it, but I was very distracted. Spencer, you were mentioning you were distracted by Jennifer Lawrence. Mm-hmm. I was distracted by the fact that nobody had a name. Nobody ever called anybody else a name. The only thing that you had to define the people was their relationship to each other. Husband, yes. Wife, brother, son, father, mother. It was those primary relational terms that were occasionally used. That was your only frame of reference for, you know, the identity of each person or figure in the story. And that, to me, I understand the point, but it was very frustrating.
I can agree. I think one of the biggest things was the amount of time spent, obviously, like what Chad said, the amount of time spent in the beginning, just wasted time that could have been used to, because I get the idea of creating pace, you know, creating a good pacing for a film. That's fine. But when you're ramping up a film like this and you're eventually going to get to a certain place, it doesn't need to take 2 hours to get there. You know, this film could have easily been done in an hour and a half, maybe less than an hour and a half. And I think it would have still had a similar impact. And similar to what you were saying about Jennifer Lawrence, my biggest pet peeve was the just no purpose at all usage of the cameo in the film. I don't understand it. I don't know why. It was placed in there. I don't know why it had to be her. Like, I just, that, I think in my mind, I spent too much time trying to figure that out. Like, well, why her? What is she?
The cameo.
The cameo of Kristen Wiig as the publicist in the film. I was just like, this doesn't make sense. Why is she there? Who is she? What is she to, you know, why is she so valuable that they had to give this role to Kristen Wiig?
Oh, I can tell you the answer to that.
Please.
The hostages. The hostage sequence, Kristen Wiig, the performer, as a comedian, and initially a very likable character, the dispassionate way that she deals with the hostage people, you don't even know who they are or why they're there or why she's there with them, the jolt that you get when her character behaves the way that she does, that was a mousetrap. Like, that was a bait and switch. Like, that. She's so likable. She's even likable when you see her, even though she's a little zany. Like, okay, what? You act like you know me, but you don't. You want a picture with me, but then you're pushing me away. And then suddenly, while I'm walking through the room, this happens, and I don't know how to process it. And I think that was very intentional. Like, you wouldn't choose just anybody to do that. You would need somebody. Hmm. Doesn't have to be Kristen Wiig, but it was in this case. You need somebody that you're banking on the audience being comfortable with them already so that they are shocked when that particular sequence happens. That's my opinion.
That makes a lot of sense.
There is a sense of logic within that. I just, for me, I don't know. I just couldn't see it. I don't know. Maybe after I process it a little bit more, maybe it'll be a little bit more apparent. But for me, object, square, hole kind of thing. But all in all, I think the film does have a really unique message. It really does do that certain type of thing that really hasn't been done quite yet, and in the very much so Aronofsky fashion. So, in conclusion, how many monocles and does it pass or fail, Chad?
This is a really difficult question. I've been thinking about this, like, literally all day, because I didn't enjoy the experience of watching this movie, but I tremendously respect the risks that it took and the way that it relied on me as a member of the audience to try to make meaning out of it. Again, I don't think that there's like one meaning that the team behind this movie wanted the audience to pull out from it. I think it's left up to your interpretation in many ways. And that's why you have people who are coming out very divided about, I understood it, I didn't understand it, I liked it, I hated it, whatever. And I think all of that, the effect that it has on you, I mean, what movie does that? Like, what entertainment product really does that anymore? I think it's gutsy. I think it's fascinating. It's not enjoyable, but it's extremely compelling and interesting. I think I might answer differently tomorrow, but I would actually say that the movie passes for me because of those reasons, and I would give it 4 out of 5.
You would really give it
4 out of 5? Even
though
I didn't enjoy it.
Huh.
I would give it 4 out of 5.
So, Spencer, we ultimately grade a film by, first off, does it pass or fail, and how many monocles out of 5 we would give it?
Okay.
So, what about you? Does it pass or fail for you, and how many monocles would you give it?
I'll give it a pass for me, and I would probably give it 7 out of 10. And I know you just said it was out of 5, but this movie makes so many extra steps that I feel like that is like, you have to convert it down extra steps.
It's off the grid.
This guy.
Gonna have him back.
Well, after that one, I have to agree with Chad. This film really does something unique, and it is something that is one of those opportunities where if you can see it once, that's great. I don't plan on seeing it again, because one is more than enough times to see it for me. But I am going to pass it for what it does artistically, what it does, and how it just interprets a story that many people have tried and have done just really so many sacrilegious things with this source material and seeing what this person is doing, and it wasn't seriously too far off from the original source material to say it was sacrilegious. It was interesting. But I would say that I don't see it as high as like a 4 out of 5. Maybe I think I would probably see it as more of like a 3.5 out of 5. There was a lot of stuff that I saw in it that I really still am surprised that I saw. And it is one of those movies that kind of haunts you in not a horror type way, but in a way that you're like, man, this film has a lot of stuff into it. Yeah.
I mean, it does. And I would actually, in counterpoint to you, I would err with Spencer and say, even though I didn't feel completely lost after the one brother killed the other brother and I kind of had an anchor point, I didn't feel completely lost. However, I know that there was stuff that I didn't notice. Mm. Because this first experience just washes over you.
Yeah.
Knowing what I now know, I would like to go see it. Not go see it again, but probably rent it on Redbox or something. I would like to view it again.
Where I could pause it and take a little bit of time.
Yeah, because...
Like, all right, let's pause, kind of refill.
You already know the shock factor stuff. Yeah. That's there to kind of hit you in the gut and or distract you. So now you already know that stuff is going to be there, so you can pay attention to some of the more subtle cues throughout the entire thing. Minus Michelle Pfeiffer, because she's not subtle in any way. She's just like, she just tears it up.
So that's our thoughts. Let us know what you think in our comments below on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we leave, we're going to leave you with a little bit of movie news. And the big news that's coming out right now all over the internet is the initial reactions to Blade Runner 2049. So here on the Filmlosophers, we've been ranting and raving about this film. We have so many high hopes for it in terms of what it's going to do for the franchise, how it's going to like just prolong this franchise and create a trilogy, God willing. We'll see. But the film,
and by we, Eddie means the royal we, because he's extremely invested in this, and I didn't like the original movie.
I love the original one.
Now, to be fair, it's been 15 years since I've seen it, so I do need to watch it again before we see the new one.
It's true.
I might respect it a little bit more now than I was able to when I was younger, but you are gung-ho about this.
I am. This film holds a lot of, like, so everything that I love about
sci-fi... And it sounds like it's going to deliver for you.
Oh, yeah. Everything that I love about sci-fi was rooted in what Blade Runner delivered. So, you know, this film and being in the hands of Denis Villeneuve, I have high hopes.
Who is brilliant.
Exactly.
Totally brilliant.
So it looks like Christmas came early for fans, and everybody that had a chance to go see this film in the small screenings that they had in limited amount are giving their first reactions, and it's all positive. Here's just a sample of what critics are saying. Absolutely stunning and a sci-fi masterpiece. It's ponderous, powerful, visually mind-blowing, absolutely fantastic. One person said, I saw hashtag Blade Runner 2049, and it is, in all caps, breathtaking. So, I don't know about any of you guys, but this just, like, seriously, like, amps me up to, like, for when this film comes out, I'm praying and hoping that there is a press screening, because I need to see this movie like yesterday.
Well, the good news is you don't have to wait too long, even if there isn't a press screening for
right,
us,
2 weeks.
Because it comes out October 7th. But I do love that for the first time ever in the history of the film Lossifers, Eddie just became an audio billboard.
It's true. I have no idea.
I mean, you literally were like those like big movie quotes that they put on the trailer, and then they put the person who said it really, really small because it's some like person that they paid off usually.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like what you just did, and that was fascinating. I loved it.
I'll send my my bill to the company and have them, you know, pay me out.
Oh, well, there you go. What is it, Fox? 20th Century Fox?
I want to say it's 20th Century Fox.
I'm not sure about that, but I think it's Fox.
I don't know. But we're excited. So with that, a couple of upcoming weekend releases to let you know. There's Tom Cruise's American Made and Flatliners, the remake of the early 90s film. So check them out. Let us know what you think. And also check out Mother. Let us know what you think about that film as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts. If you totally disagree with what we're saying, we want to hear it. If you agree, we'd like to hear that as well. You know, kind of validate us. Let us know we're doing an okay job. That'd be fine.
Mother!
But I want to thank Spencer for being on board with us today. Spencer.
I also want to thank Spencer.
Hey, you guys are welcome.
Sorry, you said I. So no. I wanted the record to state that we both thanked Spencer.
So as the record stands, we thank Spencer for being a part of today's show. Spencer,
thank you, Spencer.
Where can people find you at on social media? What's your Twitter handle?
Oh no, I'm
not. Oh, you're not on Twitter.
No one can find me.
No one can find you. So the man is off the grid. So the only place you can hear him is exclusively here on the Filmlosophers.
Woo-hoo!
Let's keep it that way. Like we said, let us know what you think on our Facebook page or our Twitter page, and we'd love to hear from you, all right? So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.